I remember Sandy said one time when he was first my sponsor, he told me, if you really want to know happiness, seek to be ordinary. And I said, oh, no. You seek to be extraordinary. Everybody's ordinary. You seek to be extraordinary. And he said, no, you seek to be ordinary. And of course that's true. My reading this morning in a Kempis points that out as well as anything, that the goal was to seek to be ordinary, to see how far I fall short of the mark. And if I'm not falling short of the mark, then my sights are set too low. These are some of the things that the 10-step tells me. Once this healthy practice, this practice of looking at ourselves, taking personal inventory, once this healthy practice has become grooved, it will be interesting and profitable. That the time it won't, that time it takes won't be missed. One of the things that I do, and this is just the way I do it. I took a look at, on a daily basis at night, I take a look at when I'm disturbed. You know, in the big book, in the 11th step, page 86, it tells me to look out for certain things. And what they really are, they're symptoms to a spiritual illness. It's pride and fear and things like that. And what I like to look at also at the end of the day is conflict. Was there any conflict in my life? Was I disturbed about something? And you know, in the 10-step axiom, of course, it says it is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. If someone hurts us and we are sore, are we in the wrong also? But are there no exceptions to this rule? What about justifiable anger? If someone cheats us, aren't we entitled to be mad? Can't we be properly angry and self-righteous? You know, I had an experience with this a few years ago. A company cheated me out of a substantial amount of money. And I had my case all put together. And I sponsored lawyers. I always try to sponsor at least one lawyer at all times. Diverge here for a minute. I worked for a man one time, and he was a lawyer. We were having a board meeting, and the only seat left was next to him, so I went in and sat down next to him. And he said, well, I'm glad you're sitting beside me, Keith. He said, I always have my lawyer on the other side of me. He said, do you know why that is? I said, because you don't trust him behind you? Yeah. He didn't think it was funny. I had my case all made out, and I had a contract, and we're going to sue, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, so I went and talked to Tom about it, and Tom said, well, that's one course of action. He said, why don't you pray for some alternatives, or maybe even a different way to look at it. But that's certainly one course of action, and that may be the course you want to take. And I prayed about it, and I thought about it and everything, and I think about it, I get angry, and that sort of thing. And here I am doing what I want to do, and I'm living with this. And then I stopped and I really thought about it. And I said, let me look at it differently. So I got out my little yellow pad and my number 2 pencil, and I began to write about it. And what I realized that for a few years, this company had allowed me to do things a lot of companies never would do. They never, except for one time, ever gave me any grief about leaving early Friday to go to a conference, to speak at a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to say of my schedule, if I wanted to go to the hospital on a 12-step call, I put everything on hold and I went. And so for 3 years, they allowed me to do an awful lot of stuff that perhaps would not have been permitted someplace else. Now, the truth is I wouldn't have worked someplace else that wouldn't permit that, but I mean that's just the reality of the thing. And I stopped and thought about it, and I said, you know, we're even. I went back and told Tom. I said, you know, I've prayed about this and thought about this, and this is what they've done. As far as I'm concerned, we're even. And I said, let it be on them, not on me. And he said, that's fine, but you have to write them a letter and tell them that. He said, otherwise the temptation will always be there to pull out the old paperwork. And he said, maybe you'll be sponsoring a new lawyer who doesn't have anything to do. And that's the way alternative thoughts go. There was a time when there was an either and or. I remember when my estranged wife served me again with papers to go to court. And I called up Sandy and I said, I got to talk to you. So Sandy was driving from Washington to Baltimore. And sober this time about maybe not long at all. No, we were divorced by this time and served me papers. I guess I was sober about 4 years. And I immediately had a plan. I've always had a plan. And I haven't always verbalized it, but it's right there. And the minute something happens, a plan comes out. And it's a good plan. And so I had a plan, and I said, she's taking me back to court. And I said, I can't live like this anymore. And I was terrified of court. And court had not been my friend. And so he said, well, he said, I understand that. He said, what's your plan? I said, well, I'm going to sell everything I have, and I'm going to buy a camper. And I said, a pop-up camper. And I said, I'm going to drive around the country, and I'm going to go to AA meetings and things. I said, now I'm going to take... What are you laughing at? This is a good plan. I'm offended. I said I'm gonna put the money in the bank and I'm gonna pay child support. It's gonna be paid, drafted every month into my wife's account or ex-wife's account. I said I'm gonna pay child support. I don't want to do anything wrong here. And he said that's a good plan. He said I see a few flaws. Can I point them out? I said of course. And he said, it gets awfully cold in the winter in North Dakota. I said, well, I'm not going to North Dakota, Sandy. I said, I was going to go to San Diego. He said, no. He said, the first place they look for ex-husbands who buy campers is San Diego. He said, that's the first place they look. And he said, and if you're not there, they'll look in the Keys, because he knew I liked the Keys, And of course, I started laughing. He said, can you think of an alternative to that plan? And this is the truth. Now, I'm sober 4 years. And I said, the only other thing I can think of is to kill her. I mean, I was a man of extremes, run away or kill, And I said, but they'd suspect me right away. He said, oh, yeah, you'd be one of the first people they'd want to talk to, So he said, could I make a suggestion? And I said, sure, what? And he said, why don't you call her up and ask her what she wants? And I said, that's amazing. But then I said, the thought that flashed my mind, I knew better than to say it, was, then that would mean she wins. Wow. I was really over all that, wasn't I? I forgive, but I never forget. And so I said, I'll do that. So that evening I called her up, and I said, I got your papers. Okay. I said, what is it that you need? And she said, this is happening to kids, and have an opportunity to get them into this school, and I think it'll really be good for them. And I said, well, I think that's a wonderful idea. I said, I'd be glad to do that. She said, you will? I said, yeah. I said, look, I'll send. I said, I just sent the check off for this month. I said, I'll send the additional money. She said, well, I don't need it till next month. I said, no, let me send it. So let me send it. I said, use it for something else. And so I did, and it was so easy. And she said, I'm so glad. She said, I hate that court business. I said, you hate it. I'm the one who always loses. I didn't say it. I just thought it. And then she said, I can't thank you enough. I said, well, it's my pleasure. And I went back to Sandy, and I said, wow, that worked so well. And so it was so easy. And, about a month later, I got a raise. Now, how AA works. It was almost to the dollar. The amount of increase that I was asked for. And I told Sandy, I said, it's a miracle. And Sandy said, I'm awful glad that you aren't out in that camper someplace. He said, we have a hard time getting a hold of you, telling you everything was all right. So of course, for the next 10 years, the question I always hear, you getting that camper out again? But that's a 10th step. And the thing that's important about all of this is connection. None of this could happen, or it couldn't happen simply and with little effort, unless I were closely connected to Alcoholics Anonymous, to a home group, to the God of my understanding, to a sponsor, If I weren't sponsoring people, I wouldn't learn or know half of what I know. You know, the only information that's of value to me is the information I'm sharing. And that's what being a sponsor is all about. It's about sharing. And what it does is it confirms what I know to be true. You know, I'm sitting talking to a guy in prison, and I'm telling him some things, and I'm driving back home. I got a couple-hour drive back from where Danny is. I'm driving back home, and I said, you know, that's true. You know what I told him? I mean, that is really true. Now, I've known it's true for 20 years, but I really know it's true. I mean, really. And that's what sponsoring people do. And if you're not sponsoring somebody, for goodness sake, find someone. Find someone who's brand new. They don't know the difference. Appoint yourself. They don't know. You know, and by the time... You know, by the time, you know, I always tell me, I'm your sponsor, and, you know, if you get rid of me, you need a lawyer, you know, something like that. But you know, find someone. I always need someone who's pretty new. I mean, my buddy, young man I sponsored sober for 7 or 8 months, called me at 2 o'clock to check something out I had said to him the night of, you know, Thursday night at 1:30 or something like that. I said, Brian, what time is it? He said, it's 1:30. Is it too late? No, it's right about on time, Brian, right around time. So I had a question. And, you know, I hung up the phone and I said a prayer for him, and I thought, you know, 27 years ago, I'd have been awake now drinking. Isn't it great? I went back to sleep and slept another 2 hours and got up and caught a plane, came to see you. I haven't been tired. I have all the energy I need. You give me that. But that's the 10th step. And the 10th step is our way of living life to its fullest. It's the 10th step is where the enjoyment and the fun and the pleasure and everything is. You know, the 10th step is how I can become a better husband and father and sponsor and human being a day at a time. I can be more satisfied and happier with who I am. It's through the practice of the 10th step. You know, the 10th step is that step that I live my life by. It's a magnificent way to live a life. And it means it can go on and on and on and on and on until I go join Hillary and Bill and Bob and all the people in a big meeting in the sky. It's endless. And of course, as these things go, the result is a closeness to God. And you get closer and closer to God as we understand Him. And I always thought I wanted to be that sobriety would bring me happiness, and you know, sometimes I've been happy and sometimes I haven't been happy, but what sobriety brings me is joy. And joy is based in hope. It's hope of the future. It's hope that a guy like me can be useful to another human being. You know, a guy who hurt and broke everything he touched can be useful in the life of another human being. And this whole business of self-image and all that business, I worry about self-image and things like that. People concerned about. Somebody said to me, how do you know you're okay? Well, I know I'm okay because I see myself in the eyes of a new man. That's how I know I'm okay. That's the reflection. That's the mirror. Some new guy who's terrified and has that fear in his eyes. You remember the fear? It's palatable. You can feel it and taste it when you're with someone who's filled with fear. And you watch that fear go away, you watch that light come on, and I'm okay. That's what a decent self-image is. It's someone who realizes he's doing the best he can with what he's got today, and he's not doing it for anything other than the fact that that's what his father would have him do. He's been given a great gift, and a gift is only good if it's passed on. That's what it's for. The 10th step is my real connection with life, and I'm connected to it on a daily basis. The 11th step. You know, the 11th step is exciting. You know, the 10th step is sort of the drudgery work. But there's a promise with the 10th step, okay? It's on page 93 in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. Whenever we fail any of these people, we promptly admit it to ourselves always and to them also. Then when the admission would be helpful. And these are the keynotes, okay? Courtesy, kindness, justice, and love. are the keynotes by which we may come into a harmony with practically anyone. To live in a life, to live in a world that's not filled with conflict is a great gift for me. My family always lived in conflict. Somebody said to me one time, why is it that you and your brother get together, you always win golf tournaments or almost win or something like that? Well, we play euchre as kids. And my family competes in everything. And competition is very comforting to me. I love it. I love everything about it. But the problem with being a competitive person is that you forget other people are in the world too. And then not everybody needs to be competed with. Some people need to be nurtured, and some people need to be cared about, and some people need to be affirmed or patted on the head or any number of things. They don't need to be competed with. And I had to learn that life is a lot more than competition. I think it was Yogi Berra said, you show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser, or Leo DeRocher or somebody. And that's funny, but I'm not sure that it's true. The problem with competition is it leads to big shotism, which is something that that is very, very dangerous for me. And on the last page of the Step 10 in the 12 and 12, it talks about learning daily to spot, admit, and correct these flaws is the essential character builder and good living. Good liver, yeah. It'll lead to a good liver, trust me. And what happens is an honest regret for harms done, a genuine gratitude for blessings received, and a willingness to try for better things tomorrow will be the permanent assets we seek. Having so considered our day, not omitting to take due note of things well done, and having searched our hearts with neither fear nor favor, we can truly thank God for the blessings we have received and sleep in good conscience. Why don't we take about the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. One of the practices that are part of the 11th step and, of course, part of the 10th step that I like to take part in, and I began doing this when I had my awakening at 6 years. One of the things that happened to me down in that hospital as my life was over, and to a real degree it was over, a friend of mine, when I got on the plane, a man who had heard my fifth step, Ed, and I never forget him for this, he handed me a copy of the Big Big Book when I got on the plane, and I had one, of course, but he handed me one to take with me. And he said, the answer is probably in here. And the other thing he said to me was, I think you're one of those guys who needs a higher power with a first name. And I know what he's talking about, but I got down, and in utter desperation, laying in bed, and truly my life was over. I mean, I couldn't even call my children and tell them where I was. I didn't know what to tell them. And I grabbed that book and just in rage and said, let's see what the hell you have to say. And I opened it to John chapter 13, and it said, do not let your hearts be troubled. Have faith in God, have faith also in me. And went on to say that it's something that I never understood before. It said that there was a place for me. And I never really believed that there was a place for me. And I was reminded of when I was in that treatment center in the beginning of this journey, that we were all supposed to come up with a question we had always been asking. I said, most of us have been asking questions all our lives. What's a question you've been asking? And it was easy. It didn't take more than a minute or two. The question was this: if I sat here and did nothing, would I be worth loving? Because I always thought I had to earn everything. And everybody said, yo, the answer is yes. Of course, I knew they were saying that because that's what nice people say. And then I discovered that moment that in fact, that's true, that there is a place for me, and I belong there. And it doesn't make me important or unimportant. It just makes me be. And I got on my knees and truly turned my will and life over to the care of God and said, I will make knowing you and service primary tasks of my life. And so I try to know God. And one of the ways I try to know God is to know the nature of God. And down there I began a practice that I do. And what I like to do in the morning is I write a little letter to God. I had a hard time praying at one time, and so I began writing it, dropping a note to God. In a notebook or something, I'll start off with a blank page, and I put the date down, and then I just write a short letter to God. And you know, at one time it was sort of like basically to whom it may concern, and now it's very intimate, dearest Father, and things like that. As these changes have taken place in my life, I feel much, much closer to God. And then I read page 86, 87, and 88. And one of the things it says is, upon awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motive. And what I like to do is plan my day that way. Now, I normally do it the night before. I like to sit down and put my to-do list down. I'm not a guy who remembers everything. I have a lot going on in my life, and so at night I can remember on my to-do list. I write down, like, maybe somebody hasn't been feeling well, I'll call them, or I have to write a letter to Alan or one of the guys I sponsor in prison or whatever, and I put down those to-do things on that list. And then the next morning I look at that. That's part of this whole thing, and I look at it, and I ask that whatever I do be divorced from self-seeking motives, because self-pity and self-seeking motives are a big part of my life in the past. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried that for a while. What used to be a hunch or an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude with a period of meditation and prayer, that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially to be for freedom from self-will, and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. One of the things I like to do when I get to go places and talk to people is my prayer is usually, please let them hear what you want them to hear and not what I say, and let them remember the lessons you want them to learn and not my name. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. Praying with my wife is the most intimate thing we do. Now, we do some other stuff, but praying with her is the most intimate thing we do. If we belong to a religious denomination that requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. I like spiritual practices that have to do with the church I belong to. And I also use different books. It's funny, through the years I've found this book to be useful. God Calling was invaluable to me for a number of years. And then one day I kind of picked up something else. And in the last few years it's been The Imitation of Christ by Thomas Kempis. And in there I find ideas. The other thing I like to do, but I do it at night, is I like to read the proverb for the day. There are 30 of them. And so it's easy to keep track. It's like doing the traditions every month. It's easy to keep track. Let me see. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated, doubtful, and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves, many times each day, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, worry, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works, it really does. And during the course of the day, I try to remember, there was a wonderful book that I read for a number of years when I was at first coming to the program. It was called Practicing the Presence of God. And there are a lot of habits that I can get into to practice the presence of God. And if I can practice the presence of God, then my decisions are always other-oriented and not self-centered. At night, I like to pick up the thing during the day, and if I have a few thoughts about the day, I write them out. You know, if there are a few things that I've done that I probably need to undo or to reconsider or maybe to talk to Tom about or Mike or somebody, I jot those things down. And then I read this. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? I stop and think about those things. Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, or what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. You know, I've always had a tendency to want to go away. I mean, going away has always been one of my fondest dreams. I never exactly knew where. But wherever it was going to be no worry, no anxiety, no concern, no nothing. That's what away meant to me. And the problem, of course, is there's no away. It's all right here. And away is, you know, they always say, away I take me, and once I arrive, I'm there. And that's the problem. And so, peace of mind, contentment, serenity, nearness to God, those aren't places. Although there are places we retreat to, like this place, it's very special, very sacred, and very holy, where I experience great things. Recently we were at a Trappist monastery in the Rocky Mountains, and we did a 12-step retreat, and I spent a lot of time in the chapel, mainly because there was 7 foot of snow outside, and I gave my daughter specific instructions: if they ever catch me in the snow, get me to detox. There's been a terrible accident, and but that was a very special place, and I toyed with the idea of wouldn't it be nice to come here and live? And then I said, of course it wouldn't be nice to come here and live. You know, God's given me commitments. And I wouldn't be happy or peaceful living here. Because I will only be happy and peaceful if I'm doing what I believe God's will is for me today. And that's what's indicated. There's something in my book. There's a plane I'm supposed to catch, or there's someone I'm supposed to talk to, something like that. That's what will bring me peace. So I can have peace in the frantic life. I have a friend, Father Bob H., who's sober almost 40 years now. And I watch the way this man lives his life, and I admire it. He's a guy who knows how to move and move properly. When he goes to a new town, he goes to a meeting every day for 90 days, and he passes. You know, sober, you know, and then finally somebody will say, how long are you sober anyway? Well, a long time. How long? Well, 38 years. Anyways, why aren't you leading meetings? Why aren't you? He said, because I want to become part of all of this. So first he sits and listens, and then he gets involved. He told me a practice that he's done now for 30 years, and I really like to do this, and I do it some of the time. And that is that he starts every day with a quiet hour. He sits and he reads, he meditates, he thinks. No external distractions. He spends an hour with God. And he said that his communication with God has increased tenfold. And I said, how is it that you can manage an hour? Because I know the man, the life he's led. I said, how is it you can manage an hour? He said, well, I don't have any time. That's why I spend an hour. He said, if I spend an hour, I have all the time in the world. He said, but if I get up and start in my day right away, I always run out of time. And of course, what he means is that he's able to make judgments if he spends this hour. He's in tune with God, and he's not running around foolishly burning up energy, like the book says. The 11th step is really a process of getting closer and closer to God. It isn't separated from the 10th step, because it gives me the spiritual ammunition I need to lead the active life that the 10th step calls on me to lead. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't times that we rest. Of course there are times we rest. You know, towards the end of this month, I'm going to go. I've got a thing in Las Vegas, and my wife's going to go back to North Carolina, and I'm going to go out and spend a few days with Dumb Denny. And we're just going to walk, and we're going to talk, and we're going to play golf, and we're going to be brothers, and we're going to talk about some serious things in our lives, and about Dad, and things like that. But it's going to be a relaxed time. It's going to be a time when I relax and kick back and lay back, and I sneak in the back of meetings and listen and get out of there and things like that. And that those are times everybody needs, of course. But I'm going to be tired if I'm not actively doing God's will. If I'm actively doing God's will, I always have the energy. Now, there's one story I'd like to tell, and Mike W. can attest to this, because I'm not even sure I believe it. I don't know if anybody remembers the gas shortage, and it's about being about God's will. You know, there was a gas shortage back in the 70s, and a couple times, and the second one, I think, was 78 or 70, 79 it was. And you're always out of gas, especially in a town as big as Washington. I mean, the gas lines were miles long and that sort of thing. So we live near a service station. And so what I do at night is pull my car up to the pump, right? And so the next morning, I put on my bathrobe and I get my coffee and in my pajamas and slippers, I'd walk down over the hill with my cup of coffee, sit in my car, and when they open the service station, they filled me up first, you know. I know the neighbors must wonder, what's this guy doing walking down the street in his bathrobe and pajamas with a cup of coffee? I was going to get my car full of gas. But it's sitting down there, and I get a call from the intergroup office, and they said, we have a 12-step call. Can you take it? And I said, my car is on empty. And a guy said, this man is really desperate. I can't find anybody. It was over in Bethesda, and I was then living in Silver Spring, Tacoma Park area. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I'll take responsibility for it. Because there were 7 townhouses, and when I moved in, I got 5 friends in AA to buy them. So it's sort of like, you know, Serenity Hill there. And the other guy, we 12-stepped, he came in eventually. So I went down to see my buddy Mike, who's about 4 doors down, and Mike said, Keith, my truck is absolutely empty. I give you that. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I said, well, you know, I'm going to head out. I said, the worst thing I can do is I run out of gas. And I said, I'm going. So I got in a car, and I took off, and went around the Beltway, and I'm going down Old Georgetown Road, and I find this guy over in Bethesda, and we sit and talk. Well, this guy's coming apart like a cheap suit, and I didn't have any booze to give him or anything like that, and I said to him, I'll get you to the hospital. So I said, God, if you get this man to the hospital, I'll walk home to get him to the hospital. So we drove down to the hospital and got him checked in. And by the time we got him in there and everything, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. I thought, you know, well, I'll go see some friends of mine. Well, they weren't home. So I said, well, I'll drive back. I'll get as far as I can. So I start back, and I get up to where Old Georgetown Road and Wisconsin Avenue cross, and there's a huge service station over there, and the lights were on. So I went driving into that service station, pulled up next to the pump, and the guy came running out and said, we're closed. I said, your lights are on. And he said, they're not supposed to be on. He said, I thought I turned them off, but we're closed. And I said, well, you better give me gas. I'm not going anywhere, so I'm out of gas. He said, look, buddy. He said, I'll give you gas. He said, I'm going to turn the lights out so nobody else comes in. So he turns the lights out, and he filled up my car, and I'm waiting inside. And he came in, and he said, something wrong with a pump. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I put 25 gallons of gas in your car. He said, your car only holds 21 and a half gallons of gas. He said, I'm going to charge you for 21 and a half gallons of gas. I said, no, I want to pay for 25. And he said, but he can't get 25 gallons. I said, look, God loaned me a few gallons of gas. I want to pay for it. Now, Now, you can believe whatever you want to, but I know how that car ran. And now, if I had gotten in a car that was out of gas to drive to Bethesda to have an affair with somebody else's wife, you think I'd have run out of gas? You bet your pippy I'd have run out of gas. But because I was about God's work, I was given what I needed. And that's what the 11th step confirms for me all the time. Of course, the next morning, I'm waking Mike up at breakfast. I couldn't sleep all night. I said, God, blow me 3 gallons of gas. And these things happen, and they'll happen in our lives if we allow them to happen. That's the magnificence of being a part of this program. It's not drinking. It only begins with not drinking. And then the whole world opens up, a world of the Spirit that we never knew existed before. You know, the book says we wouldn't want to miss it. You know, you don't want to miss it. You don't want to watch people get well. You don't want to watch you don't want to miss watching these things. It's too incredible to contemplate. You know, the 11th step is where Bill entered in the 12 and 12 is where he introduces us to the concepts of the prayer of St. Francis. You know, and basically the prayer St. Francis says, make me second, or I'll be last. And it said, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. Where there is hatred, may I bring love. Where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. Where there is discord, I may bring harmony. Where there is error, I may bring truth. Where there is doubt, I may bring faith. Where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. It is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. If I could live like this, I would live anxious-free. All my anxiety has to do with what's going to happen to me. And that's what the 11th step reminds me of. What's going to happen to me or mine or my stuff. One of the things I do in the 11th step, and I talked about it in the 3rd step, when we talk about God as we understand Him, is I meditate on the nature of God. I'm not a person who can meditate the way a lot of people meditate. You know, if I sat in a lotus position, if I got in a lotus position, I would need an ambulance. Now, I've got nothing against people who can sit in a lotus position, a little limber schmucks, but I have a chiropractor. I have to tell you this. I'm telling you, everybody is an expert on alcoholism. I was in this guy's office, and he's a good chiropractor, you know. I mean, heck, I'm hitting the ball about 15 yards further than I was, so he's a good chiropractor. And he's doing what I went there for. It doesn't hurt, and I can hit the ball further. But he was telling me, he was saying, he's one of these guys, you know, the whole world starts and ends at your spine. And he said, he's always excited about things, and he said, it's too bad. He said, how long have you been without a drink? I said, a little over 26 years. He said, it's too bad that I wasn't in practice 26 years ago. And I said, why? He said, well, he said, I'm working with a couple guys who drink too much. And he said, they've stopped drinking as I've manipulated their spine. And I said, well, I said, that would have been great. I said, I could have been a very limber lunatic. So, I mean, the people don't understand what alcoholism is. They think it's drinking too much, you know. That's just the price of admission, you know. Alcoholism is a complete deterioration of emotional, physical, and spiritual being. Drinking too much is just the part that tastes good. You know, I mean, that's nothing, you know. I mean, that's drinking too much is the easy part. Came natural. I made that look easy. It's living, you know, that became the problem. What I like to do is meditate on the nature of God. And to me, God as I understand Him is the nature of God. I always hear people say, oh, I don't understand God. Of course we don't understand God. But I can understand something of the nature of God. And we ask that question all the time. We ask the question, what would the Master do? How would God do this? What would God have me do in this situation? You know, how would God handle this? What would He have me say? Would He have me say I'm sorry? You know, what would God do? So I try to meditate on those things. And when I think about things that I didn't do as well as I wanted to, I ask, how could I have done them better? What would God have wanted me to do? And then I learn about the nature of God. I'd like to forgive wrongs done me. I can't do that on my own. But I realize that God, that's the nature of God. God's nature is to forgive. Maggie was talking about it this morning. 7 times 70 times. That's a lot of times. Of course, we know 7 is one of the perfect numbers that has to do with eternity. So 7 times 70 means forever. Forever. And I always, you know, God doesn't know much about time. There's a guy who sings a song that's sort of amusing. He's singing along and he said, God, what's $1 million to you? And God said, about a penny. And he said, God, what's 1,000 years to you? And God said, about a second. And he said, God, could I have a penny? And God said, yeah, in a second. So we understand something of the nature of God. And that's what the 11 steps about. It's not that I become a guru or, you know, ascend to the seventh heaven or mountain or anything like that. Although all that's interesting and all that's wonderful, and I've pursued a lot of it, and I find it very, very interesting. But for this alcoholic, as a practical matter, if I'm going to keep my feet on the ground while my head's in a cloud, how do I help the next suffering alcoholic? New or old in this program? What do I do for the next human being? In or out of the program? That's the only proof I have that the 11th step works in my life. It's that I'm doing the 12th step. You know, and the 12th step has the great promise that can't happen to an alcoholic, and that is having had a spiritual awakening. The great promise. The thing that millions of alcoholics have died without. And very, very few were afforded prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I say, and it's true, the great miracle happened in 1935, and our choice is to get involved or not. Maybe, you know, we always say your life's a miracle and this, and I guess it is, but the miracle happened. The way was given to us in 1935. Now, my choice is to get involved the way it is, or to alter it a little to suit my unique personality. And then I usually end up throwing up on somebody or something. But having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to just carry this message to alcoholics and to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. My sponsor, when I first met him or first heard him, gave me a concept that was revolutionary to me. He said, my name is Tom. He said, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I'm married. He said, I mean really married. He said, I'm not just married when I'm home. He said, I'm married when I'm away from home. He said, I'm a member. He said, I'm a citizen of Aberdeen, North Carolina. He said, now it's not a great town, but it's my town. And I live there, and I'm involved there. And I was overwhelmed. What he was saying was there was a place he put down roots. There was a place he claimed. I immediately went out and got a library card and registered to vote. And I became a citizen immediately. And I began to belong where I lived. Now, I've lived a couple places since then. But I go get a library card and I register to vote. And I go and vote even if I don't know what the issues are. I figure I'm going to be right half the time. Citizen of this country, and I'm going to exercise all the rights and privileges thereunto pertaining, and I belong. And that's what practicing these principles in all our affairs is involved with. It's being a member of society. It's being here. And of course, the great gift is to carry the message, like that man in the bed who was a different color and everything else, but we're exactly the same. And we could speak a language of the heart that only we could hear and only we could say. And we spoke together. And I left that room with as much or more than he had. And that's the way that things work. Now, a lot of 12-step calls don't go that well. one of my old-timers, one of my dear friends, was I shouldn't tell stories on him because he's gone now, but he told stories on himself, and he always laughed, and his name was Buck Doyle. And Buck Doyle was the 12th steppinest man I ever met in my life. Buck Doyle's car wouldn't start if there weren't three new guys in it. And there was always somebody shaking it out on his sofa. And I mean, he was just that kind of guy. But he had this great ability to laugh at himself. And I was at a meeting at the Delray Club one Sunday, and he came in shaking his head, and he said, "Boy, you wouldn't believe what just happened." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "I was on a 12-step call." Well, that wasn't unusual. I mean, you know, he's on a 12-step call every day. But he said, "Yeah." He said, "I went to see this guy over in Colorama Street." Well, that's where I hit bottom, and I can tell you that it's a nice street now. I was always either too early or too late when it came to nice places to live. But it's a nice place now, but then it was just terrible, and, you know, walk up tenements and everything. And he said, "I couldn't get anybody to go with me because all your holy rollers were at church." That's what he said. He said, "So I went by myself," and he said, "it was three floors up," and he said, "I knocked on the door," and he said, "this woman answered the door, and she had this dirty, torn dress." And he said, "I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous," and she said, "he's in there." He said, "so I went in," and he said, "there were two little kids in there." He said they were dirty. He said, "their diapers were so full, they were dragging on the ground and everything." He said, "the place smelled." And he said, "I went over to this room," and he said, "there was a man sitting on a bare mattress on the floor with the phone in front of him." And he said, "there was no other furniture in the room." He said, "so I sat down on the floor," and he said, "I told him, 'Hi, I'm Buck. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I understand you want to talk.'" So Buck did a 12-step call, and he said he was with the guy about 45 minutes, and finally the guy said, "Well, that's fine," he said, "but," he said, "I don't think I'm an alcoholic." And Buck said, "I lost it." He said, "for God's sake, man, what do you mean you're an alcoholic?" He said, "look at that poor woman out there in that dirty, torn dress." And he said, "those little kids running around in dirty diapers and everything." He said, "look at you. You're sitting in this room." He said, "there's no furniture in here. What do you mean you're not an alcoholic?" And the woman stuck her head in the door and said, "excuse me, sir, I don't know this man. He just asked to borrow my phone." And I said, "what'd you do, Buck?" He said, "I got the hell out of there. What do you think I did?" So we have times like that. You know, not everything goes not everything goes the way it's supposed to be going. And we have times like that, and, you know, and we have calls like that. But the beauty of the thing is, and I don't ever try to convince guys I sponsor to go on 12-step calls. I try to convince them that what they have is a special gift. And, you know, once I become convinced that what I have is a special gift, I have to give it away. I have to give it away. I think by the time a guy gets to the 12-step, if you have to tell him you have to do 12-step work or you drink, then he hadn't done the previous 11. Because a spiritual awakening is simply wanting to give to others what I've been given. That's a spiritual awakening. And there's something sacred about that. And there's something magical about it. I'll tell you a story about a guy I sponsor, and I told this to someone earlier. There's a fellow I sponsor in prison, and he's been down the better part of 30 years, and he's a little guy, and it's not good to be a little guy in prison, and you have to learn to take care of yourself, and you have to learn to do things to make people leave you alone. And when I met him, he was truly insane. I mean, he's just insane. He had thoughts running through his head, and he just couldn't shut up. And one thought triggered another thought, triggered another thought. He was just out of his mind. And he had learned a way to survive is to be crazy, and he was good at it. And so he got sober, and I began to sponsor him, and we began to talk about things. And he had a long ponytail, a braid. And I figured I knew why, but I didn't ask because it's none of my business. And the reason he had a braid was he braided a Chev in there, a long piece of steel. And that's how he protected himself. And that's why people would leave him alone, because he was crazy and he had this thing he'd stick through him. And one day I came in and his hair was short. And I said, "oh, your hair looks nice." I said, "what happened?" And he said, "I wanted it to be like yours." And I said, "what are you going to do with, what did you do with the Chevy?" He said, "I threw it away." And he said, "that scares me, but I threw it away." And I said, "you know, God never leaves us unprotected." And that's easy to say because I'm getting in a car and leaving and going home, you know. And he was sober, I guess, about a year. And he never calls me. You can call collect from prisons. They have a timer on the phone, about 10 minutes, and then the phone goes off. But he doesn't like himself yet enough to call me collect. But this time he did. And he said, I'm terrified. And it seems that a man who had a contract on him, you can get someone killed for about $30 in prison. And a man had a contract on him, he saw him getting off the bus. And the man promised him he'd kill him. And he called me up, he said, I don't know what to do. He said, I don't have any protection anymore. And I said, well, you know, you have God. You have prayer. And he said, will you pray for me? I said, of course I will. And I did pray for him. Also called some friends in the prison and said, keep an eye on my buddy for me. And they said, we will. And in that prison, they have a wonderful... The prison system in North Carolina, largely because of one man who will remain anonymous, has an incredible number of AA meetings. And not just meetings, groups. Real groups registered in New York who do all kinds of work. They fix big books for other prisons and repair those 12 and 12 charts and get them working again so prison groups can use them. And I mean, real service work. And this particular group has a 12-step list. And what you do is a bulletin board for AA. And if you want to be 12-step, you put your bunk number. Not your name, just your bunk number on that list. So my guy's turn was to take the 12-step calls, and there was a call there, so he got another guy, and he went to this bunk number, and you know whose bunk it was. It was a guy who was going to kill him. And so my guy tells him his story. And when he finished, this guy looked at him and said, you know, that's all well and good, but I'm still going to kill you. And my guy said, that's an outside issue. We don't discuss outside issues in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went up to see him a few days later, and he introduced me to his new pigeon. It was the guy that was going to kill him. And I just sat down and talked with him. Like, I like to talk with the guys who my guys sponsor. And I sat down and talked with him, and I said, you know, they'll tell you there are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, that's not true. I said, there's one hard and fast rule, and that is it is not permitted to kill your sponsor. No. You know, the power of this 12-step, you know, the power of this 12-step to change lives is beyond calculation. You know, and it's not, and we always say things like, or often feel, that we aren't competent to do it, or we don't have what it takes to do it, or whatever. And that's nonsense. It's not what we have that we carry. It's what has been given to us that we carry. If I have to do anything on my own resources, I'm good for about 12 minutes. And then beyond that, I'm just done. But if I carry what you've given me and what God supplies me with, then I can go forever. And I never need worry because I'm not responsible for the results. I'm simply responsible to carry the message. And what's the message? You're the message. I'm the message. The fact that we got a room full of people, there are more people in this room sober today than there were in the state of Alabama 64 years ago. Whole state of Alabama. There's more sanity cured, even as crazy as we feel sometimes. There's more sanity or insanity cured in this room than medical science would have thought possible for people like us. Dr. Silkworth said it well. I knew the man, but I didn't know him. He was changed. I was sober 6 months and or something, 5 months, 4 months. I go home for the first time. And I got there, and my sister was going to pick my mom up, take her to midnight mass over to the chapel in the hospital. And I said, could I go? Which shocked my mother. And then my sister walked in and looked at me, my big sister, Patty, and just began to cry. And said, my God, you're all right. I didn't say anything. All I did was carry what you had given me. My sister now has a daughter who's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You just carry what you give me and what God provides me with. That's the 12th step. It's not about technique or any of the rest of it. I think there are some things we need to learn about it. You know, I think it's generally foolish to go on 12-step calls alone. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it has to. I think the other thing is that we might want to check with our friends in Al-Anon. Because oft times people end up taking care of alcoholics instead of carrying the message to them. You know, we know we don't carry the alcoholic, we carry the message. I was up in Fayetteville, Mark reminded me, it was some years ago, and I stopped by the intergroup office in order, Julie and I were going to go to dinner, and I stopped by the intergroup office to get some where and when, some meeting locations for my home group. And they said, oh, thank God you're here. We're trying to get a hold of a man. We have a 12-step call. Can you take a 12-step call? And I said to Julia, she said, of course. And so I got on the phone, and I said, hi, I'm Keith. I'm an alcoholic. The guy said, yeah. I said, I'd like to come by and talk to you a little bit about alcoholics. He said, I know all about that crap. He said, I need a ride to the hospital. I said, well, call a cab. And I said, but if you ever want to talk to somebody about Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be glad to come. I hung up the phone with a girl that said, my God, that man may die. And I said, you know, most of us do. Most of us do. And she said, but whenever the hand of AA, whenever anybody has the hand of AA, I said, he don't want the hand of AA, he wants the hand of yellow cab. You know? And so, of course, there are judgments that we have to make. You know? Now, there may be a time when it dawns on me that maybe I do need to go give this guy a ride to the hospital, if that's what God tells me to do. But not then. I remember a 12-step... People always say there are no 12-step calls. I get a lot of 12-step calls. And I make sure I do. I remember one time a young guy called me and said, I got a 12-step call. I said, well, that's wonderful. He said, I've never been on one. Would you go with me? And I said, of course. So he and myself and my brother went over. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I had a flu. I was really feeling raunchy, but I knew that this would be better than Alka-Seltzer. So we went over to the guy's house, and the guy was drunk and arrogant and nasty and all this stuff. And the other two guys, my brother and the other guy, wanted to punch him out and leave. And I said, no. I said, well, just get him away from his house. Because you get someone away from their house, they a lot of times calm down. So we went down to the diner, and I bought him some pie and some orange juice, and he ate pie and drank orange juice. We talked to him for a little while, and he said, well, when do we go to detox? And I said, oh, have you been to detox? He said, oh, yeah, 10 times. I said, well, detox doesn't seem to do much for you. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, if detox worked, you wouldn't be here with us. I said, you'd be buying a pie. I wouldn't. And I said, how would you like to get sober? And he said, well, don't I have to go to detox? I said, no. I said, now you can do that, that's one way, but that doesn't seem to work for you. I said, how would it be if we helped you get sober? And he said, I'd like that. So I said, okay, you got to hang around with us for a few days. So I told him, I said, look, I said, I'm feeling pretty bad. I said, I'm going to go home and lay down. And I said, you take him, by now it's about 3 p.m. I said, you take him to the 5:30 meeting, and then you get him a bite to eat, take him to the 8 o'clock meeting, bring him to my house at 11. And I said, I'll watch him overnight. And I said, I have to be up the road tomorrow morning. I said, Larry, I said, you're not working tomorrow. How about you picking them up at 7? Fine. So that's what we did. So they're out running them around and everything. I went home, and I curled up in my chair. I get blanky. You know how blanky? Everybody have a favorite blanky. And I was feeling bad, and I got blanky, and I turned on the fireplace, and I wrapped up in blanky. And my wife's an intensive probation officer. Now, she's not intense because she's a member of Al-Anon, although that helps. But what that means is that's a probation officer who carries a gun and wears a flak jacket and goes around at night into the projects to check on their people. And that's what she does for a living. I know. I wish she wouldn't, too, but it's none of my business. And so I'm laying in the bed, and she comes in at 11 o'clock through the garage. And she's got her gun and everything on, and the doorbell rings. And she kissed me on the head, and she said, I'll get it. And then I realized, I said, no. And just as she opened the door, there's my brother and Luke and this guy. And he sees her standing there with a gun and badge and everything and faints. And she said, I'm off duty. I'm Keith's wife. It's all right. It's all right. You're welcome here. Picking a guy up and he's shaking and everything. So we bring him in and set him on the corner of the couch, and she went to bed. And he sat there with his eye, he wouldn't even blink. And I said to him, I said, you better drink some orange juice. No, thanks, I'm fine. And, you know, I said, look, why don't you try to get some sleep? I'm fine. You know, finally about 3 a.m, I got him to lay down for a few hours. And then Julia fixed him breakfast the next morning, which he couldn't eat, of course. But we walked him through the whole thing, and he hung around about 4 or 5 months and went back home sober. That's the kind of stuff. I mean, you know, you can't beat that. You just can't beat that sort of stuff. And people say you can't do it. You can do it. Now, I don't want to give the impression I don't like detoxes and stuff. I love them. I go to a Sunday night meeting, a detox. I go to detox sometimes and just talk to people. I go to halfway houses and just sit down. If a guy wants to have a cup of coffee or wants to come to a meeting with me, I pick him up and take him. I do those things, you know. I remember, and sure Maggie does, and that's why the Biscayne Room and places like that. I remember when we couldn't get people into hospitals. And you haven't lived till you've been in the back seat of a car with a guy going into DTs. You know, so I'm very grateful for the fact that hospitals now recognize that what we have is an illness and everything. But they don't do what we do because they haven't been given what we've been given. They've been given a lot of knowledge and that stuff, but they haven't been given the gift of talking to another alcoholic, of delivering the message, not when someone's detoxed and smelling pretty, but when they're desperate and they don't know if they're going to live another 30 seconds or not. That's when the message is available to us, and that's when we need to be given it. But again, when you get a live one on your hands, you better get them some help. I remember, I'll deny this if you ever say I said it, but one of the things we used to do in Washington, if we had somebody who was really sick and even giving them alcohol wouldn't, you know, keep them out of DTs, we used to drive them down to the White House, get them real drunk, drive them down to the White House and tell them to go over and tell that man in the booth you want to see the president. Now, here's a law that says if someone shows up at the White House under the influence of a mood-altering chemical, that they have to put them in St. Elizabeth's Hospital for observation, you know. So pretty soon my car would pull up and the guard would just reach for the phone. I guess another one that always comes to mind, I used to do a lot of 12-step work. When I was kind of new, I did a lot of 12-step work with a big guy. His name was Tom. And it's nice to, if you're going to do stuff like that, be with a big guy. I just feel comforting, you know. And Tom said, we got a call, I'll pick you up. So he's driving, and he said, it's in Northeast. And we lived in Northwest. I said, there's got to be a drunk in Northeast who's willing to do a call. He said, no, he said, this is special. I thought, uh-oh. What's up, Tom? He said, well, he said, this guy's sister called from Connecticut. I said, the guy didn't call. No, but she called, and it's going to be cool. I said, Tom? He said, no, trust me. I said, yeah, right. So he's got this VW Beetle. So we go over to Northeast, and we find this apartment building. It's about 10 floors up. We knock on a guy's door, and I hear, yes. So we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. Go away. And Tom said, your sister called and said you wanted to see us. And so finally all the chains came off the door. And there was this guy, the tallest, skinniest man I ever saw. I swear if he turned sideways and stuck his tongue out, he looked like a zipper. And he invited us in. And once we were in, he locked all the locks again. And then I looked and I saw he had a .45 automatic pistol laying on the coffee table. I thought, oh my goodness. So I said to him, may I take a look at your pistol? He said, don't touch that. I said, right, I wasn't going to touch it. And so we're sitting there and we're talking for a little while, and he keeps looking at the gun and looking at me and looking at the gun, and finally he said, I need a drink. And I'm thinking, me too. And he said, would you like something to drink? I said, well, I'd like a glass of water. And he said, all right. So he said, nothing stronger. I said, no, water's fine. And so he went out in the kitchen, and I grabbed that gun, and I took the magazine out and put the slide in the rear, and it was empty. I said to him, I said, this thing's empty. He said, of course it's empty. He said, well, I'm drinking, I can't be trusted with a loaded gun. So for some reason, he thought I was safe. So he wraps himself around me. You know, and he's like 6'6", and he wraps himself around me. We go down the elevator, we step off the elevator, and a bunch of guys standing there. Now, we had denim jackets on and that sort of thing. And one guy screams, the narc's got Leroy, and hit me. And down I go with Leroy on top of me, you know, and I said to Tom, I'm going to kill him. And Tom says, you may be the only copy of the big book these men ever read. I said, I'll be the last copy of the big book these men. So Leroy convinced him that we weren't the cops, that we were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we took him over to the detox. And he said, and I told him, I said, now when you go in there, they're going to ask if you want to be here. Tell them yes. I said, all you have to do is say yes. You know, it's okay. So we go in there, and a nurse came out and said, hello, do you want to be admitted? He said, no. I said, excuse me. So we took him outside, and I grabbed him. I slammed him down on the back of the Volkswagen, and I said, we're going to go in there. and you're going to say yes. If she asks if it's okay to cut your leg off, you're going to say yes. Okay. So took him back in, and we walked in the door. He said, please keep me. Don't send me home with him. And so they admitted him, and I came out, and there was a cop two cops standing by the car, and they witnessed all of this. And the guy said, sir, I'd just like to shake your hand. He said, that's a technique we're not allowed to use, but it seems to be very effective, you know. So the next day I was down there to make amends to the guy, and he got sober, and we became good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm telling you, it's a life you don't want to miss. My sponsor has a rule of thumb. He says, I never say no to anything because of convenience. I never say no to anything I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous because of convenience. You know, and there are legitimate reasons to say no. There really are. You know, I'm a husband, and I'm a father, and there are things that take place that I have responsibility to. And there are things I can do and things I can't do. But I never say no to something because it's not convenient for me. Okay? And I think that's a good rule of thumb. You know, the 12th step is what makes us different from almost anything else that can happen to a human being. Because the 12th step proves that it works for us. Doesn't matter if it works for the next person. The 12 steps are designed to prove that God's grace is sufficient for me. That this program has the power that I lacked in the first step to stay sober. It's given me a life that I can't imagine ever having lived. I wouldn't trade who I am for anything in the world. Anything in the world. I'm not better than anybody else. I'm just glad to be who I am. And who I am as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a member of the Midtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets 7 p.m., Mondays and Thursdays in Wilmington, North Carolina. And if you're ever there, you will be made most welcome in my home group. I want to thank Hillary for being with us this weekend. And I want to thank Marcy and everybody on the committee for asking me. I want to thank Kim and Sean for picking me up, and we had such a good time on the way up, and I know we'll have a good time on our way back, and just sharing and talking about stuff that's special to us. I want to thank Maggie for the years and the years of what you've done for us. Okay, and may we do it half as graciously and half as well as you. But most of all, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for bringing who you are here and spending this weekend with me. It's been a incredible blessing for me. You know, when I left Washington, D.C. and I moved to North Carolina, I had a situation happen to me that I like to remember. I was in a little apartment over on a lake. I drove by that the other day. Julie and I were up in Fayetteville, and I drove by that place, and I told her that's where that happened, and it was a special place. And I was sitting out on the balcony, and I was reading a big book, and I was reading these scriptures that friends had given me and told me to read and meditate on. The 91st Psalm and the 51st Psalm and Romans 8 and John 17 and 1 Corinthians 13. And I said, just read these, meditate on them, and see what's being said to you about protection and about things like that. And I was sitting out there, and I was just overwhelmed. You know, from time to time, how the presence of God is so real and so palatable that it's a given. There's no proof is necessary, no burning bushes. It's just there. He's there. And I had one of those moments, and I was overwhelmed with it, and I asked him a simple question. I said, why me, Father? Because I'd been sober then about 7 years, and I'd watched a lot of people die of this disease who I think were much nicer and more worthy than me. And I said, why me, Father? And I remember calling my poor estranged wife from that treatment center. And I said to her, after about 4 or 5 days, I said, I'm an alcoholic. She said, no kidding. And I said, why me? And she said, why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do. And she hung up. And here I am, 7 short years later, asking God as I understood him, why me? And he said, why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do. And that's the beauty of this. It's what the perfect Father would have wanted for me all along. I just got lost. You know, my little Kelly was the apple of my eye, my firstborn. I never wanted a son, I wanted a daughter, and Kelly was it. And Kelly's fiery to this day. She's fiery, and she's angry with me now, which is, and I know she's angry with me because it's Sunday, and she's only not angry with me on Wednesdays or something. I haven't figured it out, but she comes and goes. But she got that fire about her that I love so much, and I remember I took her to the playground one time, and she's an adventurous kid, but she would get so far away, and she'd look back, and she'd wave, and I'd wave, and I knew she was there, and she knew I knew she was there, and she knew she was all right. And she got away from me on the other side of the playground. She'd venture further and further away, and some kid bumped into her and knocked her down, and she became disoriented, and she jumped up, and she began to look for me, and I wasn't there. She looking, and she began to run in circles and cry, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And I was shouting to her, but she couldn't hear me because she was, you know, crying. And then she saw me. She ran over and just threw herself at me and said, "Daddy," she said, "Daddy, I thought you were gone." I said, "I'll never go. I'll always be here." And she said, "Okay." And she went on to play some more. And I remembered that experience after I got sober. And that's the way it was for me. I mean, I ran around, you know, shouting and screaming and demanding God. And he was there all along. I was just shouting so loud I couldn't hear him. And I said to him, "Will you never leave me?" He said, "I'll never leave you." I said, "Okay." And then I go on with life. I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to be here with you. I wish you just tons of service and happiness and sobriety, and God bless you, and I love you.